Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Dinner is tough for military families. During deployments, the empty seat at the table makes their absence visible. Sarah Smiley and her three young sons faced that nightly void back in December of 2011 when Navy pilot Dustin Smiley left for 13 months in Djibouti, Africa. So they decided to fill it. Each week, they asked guests to join them for a casual dinner. First up was Senator Susan Collins. 53 weeks later, they dined with neighbors, school teachers, artists, politicians, sports stars, and R2-D2. Through those meals, the Smileys survived holidays, a flooded basement, a lost wedding ring, and the daily challenges of playing single mom to three boys. They also built a community of friends they would not have known otherwise. Sarah Smiley is a syndicated newspaper columnist, and her new book is called Dinner with the Smileys. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So how old were your boys when Dustin first left for that year?
Let's see. Our youngest was 4, and our oldest, my husband left the day before our oldest's 11th birthday, and the week of Thanksgiving. And then just a few days later, our middle son turned 9.
So that's a bit of a sting. Two big birthdays that your husband wasn't around for.
In a holiday. But, you know, it's interesting. Military families, a lot of people say that, how many birthdays did he miss? How many anniversaries? And those certainly are difficult times. But you find at the end of the deployment that the worst times were the ordinary days.
Yeah. And you write a lot about those ordinary days. And you let us know from the jump that you don't like to cook. You don't like small talk.
No.
So having dinner guests once a week was actually your idea initially, but then you kind of pushed it off the burner and it got pushed forward a little to make it happen. How did it happen?
Right. Dinner time's always been really important to us. And we always sit down, the five of us, at the dinner table. And I knew from my husband's previous deployments that that's the hardest time to have him gone. So I knew that. And at one of the last dinners before my husband deployed, one of the boys said, it'll be strange not to have dad at the dinner table. So I just reacted to that, already anxious about it. And I said, well, we won't leave his seat empty. We'll invite people. But I meant we'll invite their friends. We'll have my friends over, our neighbors. I certainly didn't think it would turn into what it did turn into. But it snowballed with the boys. They started saying, oh, could we invite a policeman? Could we invite our teachers? Could we, you know, just kept going and going. But my husband was really worried about us being in Maine. Would we be forgotten? Would people really understand what we were going through? So he was the one that said, I really do hope you'll invite people over because I want you to stay connected to the community and don't isolate yourself. Reach out for help.
Mm-hmm. And your son, Ford, your oldest son, wrote to Senator Collins and she came.
She did, yes. She was the first person that Ford wanted to invite. His letter was awesome because he said, my name's Ford Smiley. These are, you know, I have a mom and a dad. It was just very cute, like fifth grader, I think he was when he wrote that. And I thought, no way is she going to be able to have time to come. But I thought it was a good exercise for him to learn how to write a formal letter, how to reach out to your representatives. And then sure enough, 2 weeks later, I got a call from Washington, D.C. that said that the office nearly cried when they read Ford's letter and that Senator Collins would be honored to come sit in his seat. And what I said was, oh, great. But inside, I was thinking, oh, no, what did I do? Because I don't even own linens. You know, I gave Senator Collins a paper towel to put in her lap as a napkin. I was totally unprepared and I don't cook. But very quickly, I learned that when you invite people to your house, they're not coming for a 4-star meal. If they wanted that, they'd go to a restaurant. They're not coming for a Martha Stewart home tour. If they wanted that, they'd go to a tour of homes. When they accept an invitation to come to your house, it's because they want to get to know you.
Well, you sometimes did eat out in restaurants.
We did.
You ate at the place where the governor lives, the Blaine House.
The Blaine House.
Restaurants, a bookstore, mm-hmm. Mount Katahdin.
Yeah.
Once. Is there any dinner of these 52 that stands out for you as the most memorable?
Actually, the one, when I started out, I didn't think I would write a book, but I knew I would write some of my columns about it. When I knew I would write a book, in fact, the very first chapter I wrote was chapter 6, and it was after dinner number 17, so we were supposed to have dinner with my elderly neighbor who had gone to assisted living, I kept pushing off the dinner because we had other guests that had pressing schedules, and I felt like Gloria wasn't going anywhere. So we had scheduled it for April, and I called the assisted living facility just to make sure everything was set up for our visit, and I found out that she had passed away about 2 weeks or a week before we were going to come. And I asked the boys what we wanted, what they wanted to do, because I didn't want to replace her dinner. And they said, well, that they wanted to go to the assisted living facility anyways and eat with her friends and neighbors. So we ended up sitting with a man and his wife who had Alzheimer's. And at that dinner, the man started to get very emotional and told me that he had been reading my columns about being lonely at dinner and that he understood because even though he had never deployed or anything, and he had had his wife for, I think they'd been married 60 years, that for the last 2 to 3 years, he had eaten alone because she had Alzheimer's. That's when it struck me that this story, what we were going through, wasn't really about the military. It wasn't really about our family. And so right then I came home and I wrote that chapter, and I knew that this was a bigger story that I wanted to share with the world to inspire people to reach out to someone and ask them to dinner.
And that was Frank and Anita were their
names?
Frank
and Anita,
that's what
yeah.
I'm remembering. The Katahdin dinner that I did mention, dinner number 35.
Yeah.
Which it seemed like a real watershed for you and your eldest son, mm-hmm. Ford. And now he seemed to take your husband's absence the hardest. How did you handle that?
Yes, he was very bitter in the beginning.
He was 11, wasn't he?
11. Yeah. And just kind of on that cusp of pre-adolescence and a lot of emotions going on and a lot of slamming doors saying he hated me, wished I was on deployment instead of dad. But through the year, I felt like Ford and I became much closer during that time. He grew up. He really took on the role of helping to take care of his brothers. And the Mount Katahdin trip, he really fought me on that. He didn't want to go. He thought it was a waste of time. It was going to be too long. But he loved it, and I loved the experience. And it was kind of a bonding moment for the two of us. So was also the dinner where we went and put flags on the veterans' graves with Congressman Michio from Maine. And my son Ford and I went off together as a team. And the people who were handing out the flags to us gave us specific instructions, and they said, each service member gets a flag. And I asked the question, their spouses too? And they said, no, only the service members. And I knew what they meant because then they might run out of flags. But I told Ford, come on, you and I are going to go do this set of flags. And when I walked away, Ford said, we're going to go put flags on the spouses' graves, aren't we? And I said, yes. But we put them in between the spouse and the service member. So that was kind of a bonding moment, too.
Sarah Smiley is with us. She's been called the Irma Bombeck for the military set, and we're talking about her family's experience having guests for dinner for the year that her husband was deployed abroad. It's a story told in her book, Dinner with the Smileys. Well, Sarah, it's amazing reading about what you do. You're working on your master's. Mm-hmm. You're teaching journalism at the University of Maine. Raising these three kids by yourself, I mean, did you ever just get exhausted and dread the idea of, oh, God, I'm going to have another dinner that I have to get together this week?
I did. There were lots of times that I wanted to cancel. But very quickly, the dinners kind of became life rafts for us. It's very hard to think about having your spouse gone for a year. But when you can take it week by week, it's kind of the day by day mentality. It made it that much easier. And so I put my focus on the dinners. You know, if I can just get to this next dinner, then I only have that many more weeks until he comes home. But there were plenty of times that I thought, I have nothing to cook. And as you know, in the book, I cooked lasagna for about 90% of the dinners. And sometimes I went into the dinners already defeated and tired and thinking, this isn't going to be good. This is a train wreck. Sometimes I thought our guests would be boring. You know, I thought, I don't know how I'm going to make this dinner exciting for the boys. But it never happened. Every single dinner showed us something different, whether we learned something, whether it was funny, whether it was surprising, challenging, emotional. And I always ended the dinners feeling refreshed, energized, and glad that I did it.
And your boys sort of hold their own with the guests. That's kind of amazing to watch. You know, they're picking up for each other. There's a kind of loyalty and cheering on of each other. You know, there's a little bickering as well. They are three boys, after all. What do you think is possible, Sarah, around a dinner table that just doesn't happen elsewhere?
I think it's the great equalizer, sitting down to the dinner table. We had a lot of high-profile people like senators and congressmen, mayors and governors. But it didn't matter what their title was or what their status was. When they sat down at our dinner table and we were passing them the ketchup or the Parmesan cheese or whatever it was hard to think of them as anything else but entirely human. And I feel like we bonded with people over the dinner table in ways that we couldn't have if we hadn't sat down to dinner. Mm. And in fact, when we had our dinner with Governor LePage, who is not very popular in our
Paul
state,
LePage,
yes,
right.
Who's not very popular in our state, I got a lot of pushback from people saying they couldn't believe I would go to have dinner with him. And so I wrote a column about it addressing that through the boys' eyes to them, he was just a man to come have dinner with. They knew he was the governor. They respected that. But he was a human being. And they judged him on a different level than through politics. They thought that was one of their favorite dinners because he played hide and go seek in the Blaine house. They served chicken tenders and ketchup. And they didn't care what his politics were. And they taught me through that we should judge people on who they are, not their job or their title.
Well, Dustin does return. I mean, I was blubbering at the end of the book at his return, which is not only a reason to be glad to have him back, but maybe on some level to think, oh, God, I don't have to do these dinners anymore. But you've kept it up.
I've kept it up. Well, because it's kind of become part of our culture now. And, you know, I mentioned that we had had some high profile guests. But what I like to tell people who have wanted to maybe do the same sort of thing or not every week, but, you know, reach out and invite someone, is that the most memorable moving dinners we had were with people whose names you won't know until you read the book. They weren't the high profile people. Mm-hmm. They certainly were memorable dinners, but just this experience of the community and people that we got to know, that's kind of become part of the boys' world. So even when Dustin came home, the boys kept it going. They said, well, if it had been a while that it had just been the five of us at the table, they'd say, when are we going to invite someone to dinner? In fact, right now, while I'm here with you, mm-hmm. It's a little bit of a role reversal because my husband is home with the kids uh-huh. for the week while I'm going around doing book signings. And so they're doing a dinner with the Smileys tonight to fill my seat. And
who are they inviting?
They're inviting two men from our community who are Mormons, uh-huh. actually. One owns an airplane company and one is a dentist. The dinners also were an opportunity to expose the boys to all different types of things, you know, different professions, different ways of living, all sorts of things. This is the first dinner I've never been part of. And I feel a little bit like leaving a baby with the babysitter for the first time. You know, I keep calling my husband and going,
Did you put the lasagna in?
I'm like, is everything okay? Are you all set? And so it'll be interesting to see tonight how that goes. And I'll post about it on our Dinner with the Smileys Facebook page.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks.
Sarah Smiley, a syndicated newspaper columnist, journalism teacher, and author of Dinner with the Smileys, One Military Family, One Year of Heroes, and Lessons for a Lifetime. Sarah's giving readings throughout New England, including the Perfect Wife restaurant in Manchester, Vermont, on Saturday. There's much more at her website, and we've got a link at wordofmouthradio.org. And from the family dining room to one of the most historic kitchens in the country, we're going to hear the largely untold stories of the first cooks to feed America's founding fathers, the enslaved chefs of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. That story, when Word of Mouth continues, after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From King George VI to former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, countless royals and foreign dignitaries have dined at the White House. But for our next story, we're slipping behind the scenes to focus on those preparing dinner, specifically two men who fed America's founding fathers. The Kitchen Sisters, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, bring us their story.
Well, now we're on tape, so can you describe your initial employment here the first day or how you met
LBJ?
The first night that I met President Johnson, it was late as usual. He was always late for meals. Now, there have been times that he'd get on the phone himself and call me and ask me how long would it take me to get something ready for the whole cabinet. And sometimes he'd walk in with them and you didn't even know he was coming. And I've seen time that I fixed a meal in 10 minutes for 25 or 30 people.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't even consider the history of the White House without realizing that the common denominator of White House life is the dinner table. My name is William Seal. I've written several books on the history of the White House. George Washington took office. He wasn't a king. He was a combination of head of state and prime minister. It never happened before. It was very delicate with him how to proceed from the diplomatic tradition, so food became very important. He had a slave chef named Hercules.
It was Hercules who really began this long connection between presidents and African-American cooks. My name is Sharon Conrad, historian in African-American cuisine. Hercules traveled with Washington to Philadelphia. Philadelphia was the U.S. capital prior to Washington, D.C.
Even with those hand-carved teeth, George Washington enjoyed good cuisine. My name is Joe Randall. I founded the African-American Chefs Hall of Fame. Wherever George Washington was, at the capital or in his home, he wanted Hercules cooking.
Hercules was commander of the kitchen. He did everything, all the souffles. He had about 8 assistants. He was very grand in Philadelphia, going down the street and people following him, watching him as he went to the market.
I am William Moyes Weaver, food historian and author. Philadelphia was the largest open-air market in the world during its day and age. The boats came in from Cuba 3 days a week. There were bananas and pineapples, people exchanging furniture for beef. If you had the money, you could get practically anything you wanted.
Hercules was noted for being a dandy. He walked through the streets of Philadelphia dressed impeccably in a velvet waistcoat with a gold-headed cane. I'm Jessica Harris, historian of African Americans and food. There is even a portrait that is alleged to have been made of him. He is this large cinnamon-colored man in immaculate chef's white and a toque. When Washington was getting ready to leave Philadelphia to return to Mount Vernon, Hercules goes missing. Hercules escapes. Washington searched for him assiduously, offered rewards, and he was never found. A French visitor to Mount Vernon asked one of Hercules' daughters how she felt about her father running away. She replied, "I miss my father, but I know that he is free, and so I am happy for him." Many of us have heard of Sally Hemings and her alleged relationship with Jefferson, which is increasingly becoming not alleged, but a matter of DNA fact. But most of us don't know about her brother. James Hemings was also a slave to Thomas Jefferson.
When he was appointed minister to France in 1784, Jefferson decided that he was going to take 19-year-old James Hemings with him to Paris to apprentice in the art of cookery.
He went from the hearth cooking that was the good, solid country cooking of Monticello to cooking on a potager, a stew hole stove. He learned the art of saucing things.
James Hemings' recipe for snow eggs. Take 10 eggs, separate the yolks from the whites, and beat the whites as you do for the savory cake, till you can turn the vessel bottom upwards.
It was a time of great upheaval in Paris. As the society was democratizing itself, so was the food. We see the development of restaurants, restaurer, to restore. Food coming out of the chateau, coming out of the royal kitchens, becoming more democratic. At the same time, the royal family is falling. James Hemings was there to see and witness these changes.
There was no slavery in Paris at that time. James could have taken advantage of that by claiming his freedom, but that did not happen.
Hemings returns to Monticello with Jefferson, and he petitions for his freedom. Jefferson insists that Hemings must wait long enough to train another.
After 3 years of teaching his brother, Peter Hemings, the art of French cookery, James was freed.
We're not really sure what happens to him after that. He was asked to return to cook when Jefferson was in the White House. But beyond that, we don't know.
Shrimp curry a la Zephyr Wright. 2 pounds raw shrimp, shelled and deveined. 5 tablespoons.
Do you remember anything in particular about the last days?
Those last days in the White House, Mr. Johnson said, are you going with us to Texas? And I said, no, that I would be staying here. And he said that it won't be the same without you. And whenever he came to Washington, he'd always call me.
Really?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that story was produced by the Kitchen Sisters, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, and mixed by Jim McKee. Up next, we're going to hear about a new exhibit at the Currier Museum of Art highlighting the work of M.C. Escher. Word of Mouth learns more about the man behind all of those optical illusions after the news.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Even if you don't know the name M.C. Escher, chances are you've seen his work, a staple of dorm room posters, nerdy neckties, and university math departments. Escher's repeating patterns, impossible objects, and mind-bending optical illusions still have broad universal appeal decades after their creation. A graphic artist by trade, Escher created complex illustrations that have inspired mathematicians and everyday people alike. A new exhibit at the Currier Museum of Art in Manchester is being touted as the largest and most comprehensive retrospective of Escher's work ever shown in the U.S. Jane O'Neill is the Currier Museum's senior educator and did extensive work on the Escher exhibition, and she's with us to talk about Escher's work. Jane, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So a lot of us have seen it, a lot of us know it, but can you describe for our radio audience maybe one famous work that can help people identify M.C. Escher?
Sure. I think a lot of times when people think of M.C. Escher, they might think of the image where it's a drawing of lizards that sort of emerge from the drawing and then become three-dimensional and sort of
crawl out
the studio and then go back into the drawing. Escher was known for making these sort of mind-bending images like this.
Now, he was born at a really interesting time, late 19th century, kind of came of age after World War I, left Italy during the rise of the fascists before World War II. A lot of chaos. Did that affect his work?
It sort of moved him around Europe a little bit, but it didn't impact his work too much. Prior to World War II, he was living in Italy and spending a lot of time traveling through Italy, and he made these beautiful landscapes. He was really inspired by the Italian landscape, the architecture there. But after World War II, he moved back to Holland, back to the Netherlands.
He was originally Dutch.
Yes. And so once he went back there and he didn't have that Italian landscape to inspire him anymore, he really turned sort of inside of himself and he started making much more creative, much more imaginative works.
That's so interesting. I would never think of him as a landscape painter.
I know. There's a lot of surprises in this show. There's a whole gallery full of just incredible prints and drawings of landscapes, highly detailed and really interesting vantage points.
So he moved away from these landscapes to more, I guess, theoretical imagery. Do we know what motivated that? I guess the move.
Yes. So in part the move, and then in part he was really inspired by one site that he had visited in Spain. It's called the Alhambra.
And there's a lot of there. The sort of
yes.
Moorish, beautiful, beautiful building and beautiful surrounding area.
Yes. So there's a lot of decorative tile work there, mosaics, and he was fascinated by the patterns there. So he started working on these patterns, these tessellations. They're interlocking. They can go on for as far as the page can stretch. And he worked on those almost obsessively for decades. And so he was really interested in math and the way things sort of fit together like that. He was corresponding with mathematicians all the time and trying to sort of figure these math concepts out in a visual way.
Hmm. Did he have any formal training in math and science?
No formal training in math or science. And he would actually sort of beat himself up about this sometimes, but he really sort of sort of aligned himself more with mathematicians after a while than with artists, because he was so focused on mathematical problems in his work.
The mathematicians, scientists seem to love his work. Engineers seem to love his work. In fact, I've sometimes considered it a kind of, I don't know, analytically minded response rather than an emotional one. Is that fair?
I think it's fair to say that, particularly for a few decades of his work, and we have a big gallery at the museum right now that's filled with these really sort of detailed, carefully drawn, sort of mathematically based works. But then after that, things shift too. And then he goes into sort of more or less impossible worlds, impossible constructions, strange reflections. So he goes from the careful landscapes to that sort of interior, sort of abstract thinking, and then just sort of branches out to something that's much more sort of whimsical and fun, but still kind of based in the math.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is he's coming of age as an artist during the 50s and 60s. And I'm thinking of, you know, abstract expressionism, you know, different kind of art, things going on in the art world. Then did artists of his day regard him as an artist or as a draftsman?
That's a really interesting question. We don't have a lot of documentation that says that he was interacting with a lot of other artists at this time. And his work is so careful and so precise and so different from the work of the 1950s. I mean, if you're thinking of something like Jackson Pollock and splatter paintings. So, I mean, really, it's during that time that he's most closely aligned with more sort of concrete mathematical thinkers mm-hmm. than with other artists.
Yeah, it's an ordered universe rather
right,
than the chaos
right.
in some way. He was actually popular when he was alive, which may be a rare thing for a 20th century artist.
Right, right. So we always think of M.C. Escher as having, you know, the posters in the college dorm rooms mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. The Simpsons, the cartoon, The Simpsons, they love to sort of do Escher spoofs. So it's really sort of ingrained in popular culture. And I'm sure if you haven't heard the name M.C. Escher, you have at least one of his images in your mind already.
Yeah, I'm thinking of you spoke of the patterns on the tiles, the birds. You know, you've
yes.
got some dark, some light, but their images are forming together. I guess you call that tessellation. Is that?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And we're so excited that he worked so much in tessellation, because that's something that school groups oftentimes work with. And so it's a great excuse to bring in a lot of students into the museum to talk about art and to talk about math.
Mm. Yeah, those are two worlds you don't often hear
yes.
put together. And mathematicians, I guess, had a great respect for him as well, as you mentioned. I read something, I think it was from, you know, a university professor in England saying something about believing that the universe may be Escher-shaped. In other words, he got it exactly. I mean, he understood cosmology. He understood the way that things fit together, patterns.
Yes, it's so amazing. And you see that sort of taking shape through the course of the exhibition. He starts working on those tiles, those tessellations, and then he actually confines it to a circle. And he's thinking about how an image can sort of spread out in the circle and become infinite within a circle. And the way he does this, I mean, mathematicians were so impressed. He got it right.
Hmm.
And it does, in some ways, sort of represent the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that with no background in math, science, it's really just sort of figuring it out visually. It's so incredible.
And it's a great favor to mathematicians, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
he shows people, you know, the casual viewer, that it can be beautiful in some kind of way.
And accessible.
Now, why do you think Escher's work fits into the realm of science fiction and fantasy stories so well? He's very popular in that set as well.
Yes, I think that really relates to the work that he was doing closer to the end of his life, those impossible constructions. There's a staircase that he represents that you see in, like, the movie
Inception.
Inception. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You're going to have to master a few tricks if you're going to build 3 complete dream levels. Excuse me.
What kind of tricks?
In a dream, you can cheat architecture into impossible shapes. That lets you create closed loops, like the Penrose Steps, the infinite staircase.
So I think that that it's grounded in that realism that he had studied so well early on in his life, that it seems accessible. It seems like a picture that you could walk right into. But then there's always that illusion. There's always that that element of surprise that I think that people who are interested in science fiction can really latch on
to
there.
And maybe to help listeners get a kind of visual cue, there is this Sprint commercial. The quarterback, Peyton Manning, is trying to find a receiver in this maze of Escher-like steps. And I look at some of these pictures, some of his images of, you know, like stairs connecting to towers, and it reminds me of very early video game imagery as well.
Yes, there are even now today, there are apps that relate so perfectly back to what Escher was doing. It's these basic ideas about exploring spaces and the way architecture works and how sometimes it can surprise you. I think these ideas are still so relevant today.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. Why is his work still relevant? Why this show now?
Well, that's a great question. I think he captured the public's imagination back when he was alive, and he lived until 72. And there still seems to be this fascination with the ideas that he was working with. And I'm not sure if there's something that's particularly relevant to 2014, but I think it still fascinates in the sense that it seems so real, but there's that element of surprise. There's the mind-boggling component to it.
Well, Jane, thank you so much for talking with us about M.C. Escher. You've got me hooked.
I can't wait to see you at the museum.
Jane O'Neill is the Currier Museum of Art's senior educator, and she worked extensively on the M.C. Escher Reality and Illusion exhibition that opens this Saturday, September 20th. It's going to be on view until January 5th at the Currier Museum of Art in Manchester, and you'll find a link with more information that's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we're staying on the math beat, this time with a look at a staple of high school calculus courses, the Texas Instrument Graphing Calculator. We're going to find out why the design has remained largely unchanged while other handheld technologies get smaller, faster, and cheaper. That's when Word of Mouth continues in just a moment. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you take a look at the slim flip phones that were popular in 2004 and compare them to the 5-inch touchscreen phablets of today, you can see how quickly devices change from one generation to the next. Incredibly, there's one gadget that has managed to monopolize a market without changing much at all over the past 10 years. The TI-84 Plus, a graphing calculator made by Texas Instruments. Matt McFarland is the innovations editor at the Washington Post and wrote about why this outdated tool continues to dominate in the classroom. Matt, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, give us a sense of just how successful the T-84 is compared to its competitors.
Well, Texas Instruments had 93% of the graphing calculator market share in the last year. It's really the de facto standard for so many students. Pretty much if you're taking a high school math course, you will probably want one. Some college students as well use them, generally like in engineering.
So how much has it changed since first introduced in 2004? Have there been, you know, updates, new generations, swiping like we see on smartphones or tablets?
Right. The device has been fairly consistent. There is a newer version, which has a color screen and more memory.
Whoa.
The TI-4, the base model, the TI-84 Plus, is essentially identical in terms of its hardware components. The software has been updated. But yeah, it's really remarkable in the case of a piece of electronics to undergo so little change in such a long time span if you compare it to a lot of other things out there.
How about the price? I remember it being a pretty steep one back in high school.
Right. Yeah, the MSRP, the suggested retail price, was $150 for the TI-84 Plus when it came out. It remains at that price. It's important to note that that's not your best representation of what you're going to pay if you go out and buy one today. Generally, from about $80 to $100 is what you would pay for a TI-84 Plus today.
That's pretty expensive. I mean, considering that so many other electronics have gotten smaller and gotten more efficient and gotten less expensive over the past 10 years. Is Texas Instruments making a pretty good profit on these?
Yes, it's hard to pinpoint exactly, but from kind of reading the tea leaves, it seems like they are doing very well. I spoke with one analyst who estimated the cost of manufacturing a TI-84 Plus at between $15 and $20. And if you look at other electronics out there, say, you know, an iPod Touch or an Amazon Fire, and you just, you know, line up the components, look at how good's the screen, how many pixels, what's the resolution, or how much memory does it have, and you'll find that the TI-84 looks a bit underpowered at the price point it's at, but it is sufficient for, you know, what students do need in the classroom. So there hasn't been a huge need to really upgrade it.
Well, that surprises me that Texas Instruments has not been forced into the same competitive one-upsmanship that so many other advices in the tech world seem subject to. Why not?
Yeah, I think that really speaks to the world of education and how our system is. Education, it's a unique marketplace in which, you know, first mover advantage is very important and network effects. And once Texas Instruments really built itself up and became the standard, what teacher or, you know, what school district suddenly wants to change to a new calculator? It's a lot of work for everyone to learn the new software and how a new calculator works. It's really great if you have every kid in a class using the same device. So even well, say Casio has some calculators with about the same abilities as, say, a TI-84 offered at a lower price point, they haven't been able to make much headway into the market.
Couldn't all the functions of a graphing calculator be done on a smartphone these days? I mean, we have apps for everything. Why haven't graphing calculators been entirely replaced?
Right. It's a great point. Just smartphones have swallowed so many of the functions of other devices we use in our lives. And there are free graphing calculator apps out there. But the problem is, what teacher really wants their kids to have the smartphone out in a classroom? There's just such a distraction risk. So, well, yeah, sure, a smartphone, it would save some people so much money and seems like a great alternative. The problem is making a smartphone a device that educators are comfortable having their students use in a classroom.
Well, Matt, thanks for filling us in on a relic that seems to be doing quite well, the TI-84 calculator.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Matt McFarland is innovations editor for The Washington Post, and you'll find a link to his article, The Unstoppable TI-84 Plus, How an Outdated Calculator Still Holds a Monopoly on Classrooms. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Mathematics has helped astrophysicists unlock the mysteries of the universe. Economists better understand the global marketplace. And it can also be used to interpret and categorize works of art. Visual stylometry is a new branch of mathematics that uses statistical analysis to determine the style of a particular artist's body of work. Jenny Chen takes a closer look at how stylometry works and what the implications of it could be.
I'm in the conservation studios at the Museum of Modern Art. It's a huge, high-ceilinged room with brilliant views of neighboring Midtown Manhattan skyscrapers. Paintings are set up on easels throughout the room.
My name is Jim Coddington. I am the chief conservator at the Museum of Modern Art in New York.
Jim is working to restore a Picasso. He's taking a varnish off.
I remove the varnish, and the trained eye is, you know, an exquisitely fantastic instrument for doing this kind of analysis, but it's not absolutely perfect.
There's a relatively new field of math that could aid the expert eye. It's called visual stylometry. Stylometry is literally the measurement of style with higher math, but we'll talk more about how that actually works in a minute. Jackson Pollock, who's most famous for his huge drip-style paintings, was among the first artists to have his work subjected to this kind of analysis.
Sometimes I use a brush, but often prefer using a stick. Sometimes I pour the paint straight out of the can.
That's Pollock speaking in 1951, and in 2005, years after his death, a question of the authenticity of a newly discovered trove of Pollock paintings gave visual stylometry its first high-profile test. Art historians were divided as to whether the paintings were really by Pollock, and there were millions of dollars on the line. To settle the dispute, Richard Taylor, a physicist at the University of Oregon, subjected six of the newly found paintings to a stylometric computer analysis by comparing them to established patterns found in authentic Pollocks. And the conclusions were pretty clear. The patterns in the new paintings were significantly different than those in the established ones. Specifically, Taylor based his conclusions on fractal geometry. Fractals are patterns that repeat at infinitely smaller scales and are found all over in nature. For example, in clouds.
If you consider a cloud and look at the edge of a cloud, it has these big bumps in there, but then it's got smaller bumps on top of those big bumps and even smaller bumps on top of those. These patterns keep on recurring at finer and finer scales.
The same is true of Pollock's paintings.
We find that they've got these big splatters of paint, but when you zoom in and look at a finer scale, you find that he's got smaller versions of those splatters, and then even smaller versions still. And so his patterns have actually got the same degree of what we call fractality as nature's scenery has.
The new paintings didn't have those fractal structures. It turns out that Pollock's random splotches are actually very, very hard to replicate. And Taylor's fractal patterns are just one of the hundreds of mathematical features analyzed in stylometry. These features could be anything from pixel density and brushstroke thickness to fractal structure. Each feature in each painting is then assigned a number. Those numbers are compared across different paintings to determine the likelihood that the works are by the same artist. Since Taylor's work, a growing number of mathematicians are doing research in visual stylometry. Young Wong is the math department chair at Michigan State University. His team has been working on paintings by the 16th century Flemish painter Peter Bruegel the Elder.
We obtained several new drawings and the museum asks us, well, could you tell us whether, you know, these were authentic Bruegel or, you know, fake? So we analyzed them, and using the features we obtained, we were able to say these were all authentic Bruegel. So we called them up and said, well, this is what we found. They said, yeah, that wasn't exactly the case.
This doesn't mean that visual stylometry is a perfect process.
Still, this is really a blind process. You can have a gazillion, you know, way of combining these data, and you still may not actually get what you want. You may not come up with something that can tell this is a Jackson Pollock.
Besides authenticating works by major artists, stylometry could be very useful for conservators like Jim. He's interested in the comparative power of stylometry. The more ways there are to look at an artist's style across paintings and through time, the more clues you have as to how a work should look and how to go about restoring it.
Visual stylometry can be just another tool in our box to aid us in this kind of analysis of images. So it's almost like a microscope to me. I can't really do my work without a microscope. There are times when I need to see deeper into a work of art.
But a question that many in the art world have is, can style be reduced to a series of mathematically significant features? Can art and math be collaborators? The answer may be yes. In many cases, both art connoisseurs and mathematicians actually reach the same conclusions. For example, they both know that Pollock's work is totally unique due to his posture and body movements. Movements influenced by physiological differences from a heart defect called Blue Baby Syndrome. Art connoisseurs know this from years of studying art, and mathematicians know it from looking at the fractals in Pollock's paintings. As for the physicist Richard Taylor, he fell in love with his first Jackson Pollock painting at 9 years old.
There is another way of picturing the disciplines, and that's that they form a circle. Art and mathematics are so far apart that they actually become neighbors again. And I really think that that's true, that both artists and mathematicians are essentially both interested in patterns in life.
This piece was produced by Jenny Chen and Molly Jean Bennett, with editing help from Kainat Khan and Alex Cloninger, and it's part of the PRX STEM Story Project, made possible by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
Thanks so much for listening today. If you like what you heard, there is much more at wordofmouthradio.org, as well as on our Facebook and Twitter feeds. Earlier in the show, we talked about a new exhibit at the Courier Museum of Art, M.C. Escher, Reality and Illusion. And we unearthed some surprising facts about his life and work. For instance, while known for his mind-bending optical illusions and mathematically inspired patterns, in his early years, he sketched landscapes and nature. You can discover more surprising tidbits about M.C. Escher at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth will be back with our weekend show on Sunday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.